At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Remember that line that I think I've used a couple of times now about us being the best-looking horse in the global economy glue factory? Yeah, well, we still are, but maybe less good-looking than we thought. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here on this Wednesday, everybody. It is the 14th of January today, and here is the way this morning went down, economy-wise. First, we learned the World Bank has cut its forecast for global growth this year. Not a whole lot, from 3.4% to 3% even, but still, it kind of did give people the willies. And the bank said to boot, the global economy is running, and this is a quote, on a single engine. That, of course, would be us. So then the Commerce Department came out with its retail sales numbers for December. And even when you take out plunging gas prices, sales were off almost 0.5% last month. So what do you suppose is going on in the glue factory, huh? Here's Dan Bobkoff.
What happened, America? Everyone thought you'd spend more money at stores in December. You're making economists sad.
Well, it was quite striking. We weren't expecting such a sharp decline. In fact, we were expecting a bit of a pop in December.
Well, certainly we're very disappointed in the month-to-month changes.
That's Bricklin Dwyer, an economist at BNP Paribas, and Jack Kleinhens, the chief economist at the National Retail Federation. Low gas prices presumably put more money in our pockets, so you'd expect we'd be spending it elsewhere. Kleinhens says we might just have to be patient.
I think it takes time for that to work through the economy.
But here's the thing about those retail sales numbers. They might be misleading. The Commerce Department looks just at how much money we spend. But consumer prices have been falling, so we could be buying more stuff just for less cash. Guy Berger is U.S. economist at RBS Securities.
In fact, the quarter might actually be genuinely good once you take into account the fact that prices are falling.
And there are other reasons those retail sales numbers don't tell us the whole picture.
It excludes, for example, a huge chunk of the services spending that consumers spend money on.
Things like healthcare or your cell phone plan aren't included. One sign services could be doing better is that we went out to eat more in December. And there's some other possible explanations. Wage growth is still slow. Chilly December is also a really hard month to seasonally adjust. And there were some pretty good deals in October and November. So shoppers might have just bought their gifts earlier in the season. In New York, I'm Dan Bobkoff from Marketplace.
J.P. Morgan Chase released, well, you could call them disappointing earnings today. By disappointing, I mean the bank missed expectations and, in fact, posted a drop in quarterly profits. But let us be crystal clear here. J.P. Morgan still made boatloads of money, almost $5 billion in Q4. $1 billion in legal costs took a bit out of the bottom line. Lawyers CEO Jamie Dimon had to hire in the wake of various government investigations. That didn't sit well at all with Mr. Dimon. He, in fact, said that banks are under assault. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson explains what he might have meant.
The assault, according to Dimon, is coming from U.S. regulators. He says the bank now has 5 or 6 regulators coming after it on every different issue, compared to the old days when it dealt with 1 or 2. And that, quote, you should all ask the question about how American that is and how fair that is. Marcus Stanley, the policy director of Americans for Financial Reform, thinks Diamond has it backwards.
Yeah, I'd say regulators in the U.S. Congress are under assault from the financial lobby, and so far they've been winning some battles.
Stanley points to ongoing efforts to roll back elements of the Dodd-Frank financial reforms passed in 2010. So who's right? John Coffey, a professor at Columbia Law School, says actually both.
What happened in 2014 is I think that regulators decided that they had been accused too long of being soft on banks, and they took a stricter attitude.
In addition to various federal regulators, lots of state regulators are now knocking on banks' doors. So while the financial crisis made it clear we need better bank oversight, Aaron Klein with the Bipartisan Policy Center thinks there's room to do it smarter, to consolidate regulators.
What we have now is a siloed system where each regulator is off on its own area, enforcing its own rules, and not coordinating or communicating or sharing information amongst them.
Klein says that makes the regulatory process more complicated and more costly for banks, and also for taxpayers. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Wall Street didn't care much for that World Bank report. No, indeed it didn't. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. It's not quite man bites dog, but oil prices did do something unusual today. They went up a solid 4% or so. Still, crude is less than half of what it cost 6 months ago. A price drop that is great for consumers, as we've said, not so good for oil companies, as we have also said. But then again, not all oil companies are created equal. Inside Energy's Emily Guerin reports from North Dakota that when oil prices drop, size does matter.
Picture an American oil company. Remember the 1980s TV show Dallas? Swaggering Texas wildcatters turned billionaire tycoons? Now get that image out of your head. The companies we're going to hear from are nothing like that.
I started Emerald Oil about 4 years ago, and we really built the company from scratch.
McAndrew Rudisill is Emerald's CEO. He's a young, clean-cut executive who used to work as a private investor in New York City. Then, North Dakota's Bakken oil boom began to take off around 2010.
Just saw the incredible opportunity that we have in unconventional resources in the U.S. and decided to get out on the ground and start drilling wells myself.
He left New York and moved to Denver to start Emerald. That's where many oil companies who work the Bakken are headquartered. The company now has 50 wells, all in the Bakken. It's an entirely different animal than, say, Continental Resources, with over 1,000 wells in the Bakken alone and more in places like Colorado and Oklahoma. And that makes a big difference.
Decreasing oil prices will impact small operators faster because they do not have rapid access to capital.
That's Niles Hushka. He's the CEO of KLJ, an engineering firm in Bismarck. You need a lot of money to drill a well in the Bakken, like $10 million. Hushka says smaller companies have a harder time getting loans to finance that. And with fewer wells, they have less money coming in to ride out tough times. Another factor is where you are drilling.
A large operator will have resources that are spread throughout a number of oil plays, and therefore they're much better protected than a small operator who at times will only have resources, for instance, only in the Bakken.
North Dakota oil companies have to pay much higher transportation costs than companies in Texas. So when you hear that oil has dropped to $50 a barrel, companies in North Dakota are only getting about $37. Geography within the Bakken matters too.
Well, if you're a small operator and you're only in North Dakota and you're in one of North Dakota's hot spots, you've got a great big smile on your face.
If you're in a hot spot like McKenzie County, you're still making money at $30 a barrel. In fact, that's where most of the drilling rigs have moved in recent months. But if you're in one of the more marginal areas,
You're finding that your wells aren't producing enough cash flow to keep you going today because of the price of crude.
Emerald is experiencing all those things. And there's not much CEO Rudisill can do except joke about the way oil cartels are forcing prices down.
I wish I had some influence on the decision-making of OPEC, but I don't think that they'd listen to me.
Next year, Emerald's going to drill fewer wells. Some other small companies are stopping entirely. Butch Butler is president of a Colorado-based oil company called Resource Drilling that is even smaller than Emerald.
I'm the geologist, the geophysicist, the land man.
Butler has just one well in North Dakota.
The accounting manager, the drilling engineer, operations engineer, regulatory manager. Let's see, what else has to be done?
A few months ago, the plan was to drill another two. But that plan went out the window when prices kept dropping.
It's been a very challenging last 30 days, boy, that's for sure.
In fact, both times I talked to Butler about low prices in the past 2 months, he joked that things were bad, but he wasn't, quote, slitting his wrists yet. He says he's trying to take the price crash in stride.
Well, you know, as I told you, I've been in this business 38 years. Truly, most of that time has been not so good.
Butler is not your typical oil man. He says he's not in it for the money. Which is a good thing, since there's suddenly a lot less of it. I'm Emily Guerin for Marketplace.
Emily's story comes to us from Inside Energy. That's a public media collaboration focusing on America's energy issues. We've all been there, right? You're out and about someplace, a song comes on, and you want to know what it is. Thankfully, there is, as they say, an app for that, Shazam. Is one of the most popular apps in the country. It's been downloaded more than 500 million times. It's been helping people identify music for more than a decade now.
We're expecting you. Won't you have a seat?
Ready to go to work?
So today on Conversations from the Corner Office, Rich Riley, he is the CEO of Shazam. Rich, welcome to the program.
Great to be here.
We should probably say as we get going that Shazam is not just about music anymore. You guys do television shows and ads. I mean, I can hold my smartphone up to my TV. In fact, I just did in my office, and it told me that I was listening to CNN Live with Ashley Banfield.
That's right. So we are building on our very strong foundation in music, but to also go beyond music. You know, most people now have this incredibly powerful device in their pocket. It's only getting faster. It's only getting more powerful. And it's the way they're going to want to connect to things around them, whether that be identifying a TV show, finding out more about an advertisement, or getting a special offer from a company. And we just announced visual Shazamming.
No, how does that work?
So this is coming soon. But you'll be able to Shazam a print ad, for example, a QR code, a package. You know, but let's say it's a DVD, for example, yeah. You could push Shazam and watch the full trailer.
This all gets back to that phrase that's sort of all the rage in this digital age, which is, of course, big data. You guys now know what we do, where we do it, and then how to feed our appetites to continue doing it. Is that fair?
So we do. People Shazam over 20 million times every day. And that's a very useful signal of what people are really interested in. So based on what you've Shazammed, we can serve content to you based on those artists, for example. And we definitely can predict hit music several weeks or months in advance of it being on the top of the charts.
And that information must be valuable to music companies. I mean, I imagine you can go to the CEO of, you know, I don't know, Sony Records or Warner Brothers Records and say, we know what you're going to have the hit with, right?
So they are very close partners of ours, and they use our data extensively to see what, you know, what music's resonating with listeners. An example would be a new track will play in a specific market, and they'll watch the Shazam hyperlocal charts. So we have charts down to the Queens versus the Bronx chart, for example, in New York.
And, oh, forget it. I bet you've got 95th Street on the Upper West Side versus 95th Street on the Upper East Side. I mean, come on, right?
We can get there. Yeah. And so they can look at that and see when that song played, did it resonate with consumers? Did it make people want to take out their phone and say, what is that? I've never heard that before, and I'm really, really curious. And that can be a strong indicator for them that they have a hit on their hands and influence their promotional efforts and expenditures and things like that.
Little known fact about this company, at least to me anyway, before I started researching this conversation with you, is that you've been around now, what, 12, 13, 14 years?
That's right.
Before Apple even came out with the App Store. I mean, it used to be that you held your phone up to a music song playing and you got a text message back?
Yeah. So we like to say Shazam was mobile before mobile was cool. And when it was originally launched, you would basically record a sound clip, text that to Shazam Systems, and it would return the name of the song, and you'd pay like a dollar for that text. So they had that up and working, and then Apple launched the iPhone, and the graphs all go up and to the right. And it took about 10 years to do the first 1 billion Shazams, and now we do a billion Shazams every, you know, 45 days or something like that.
Parenthetically, I noticed that you're using Shazam as a verb. You trying to Googleize this thing?
So we think we have become a verb. We were on Jeopardy a few months ago, which I think the official verb status. We're trying to extend the verb.
Yeah. Last thing, Rich, and then I'll let you go. It's something I did with Meg Whitman from Hewlett Packard. I did it with the president when we talked to him a couple of months ago, and it's harder than you think. But here you go. What does your company do in five words or less?
Connect people to the world.
That's not bad. And I could hear the gears grinding. That was all right.
Five words exactly.
There you go. Rich Riley, he's the CEO of Shazam. Rich, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, Rich, that was great. Appreciate it. You should know that both Meg Whitman and the president failed the test. Rich shared one of his personal playlists with us, along with the top Shazam songs of all time. They are up on marketplace.org. Coming up.
We don't consider ourselves a slap in the face. We're a banana peel on the floor.
Forget the Oscars. We've got the guy who started the Razzies, Hollywood's highest honor for bad movies. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's off 186 points today. 1% closed at 17,427 to the blue chips. The NASDAQ off 22 points, 0.4%, 4639. The S&P 500 dropped itself 11 points lower, 0.5%, 2011 there. Home builders are getting hammered in part because of falling oil prices in Texas, which is a big market for them. KB Home, its profits margin shrinking, fell 20% in 2 days, 2.3% today. Copper prices fell sharply today, and big copper producers followed suit. Shares of the biggest producer, Freeport-McMoRan, lost 11% today. J.P. Morgan Chase off 3.4%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note off to 1.85%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases the Producer Price Index for December. Nominations for the Oscars are announced in Beverly Hills. And it's where the phrase, jump the shark, all started. Television's Happy Days premiered 40 years ago. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. The 2015 Barack Obama pre-State of the Union Roadshow rolled into Cedar Falls, Iowa this afternoon. Today's talking point was access to high-speed internet. Mr. Obama settled in Cedar Falls because it's one of the few cities that's been able to build its own network. The president says the laws that govern how the internet is built basically make it too hard for cities, among others, to develop the infrastructure that could get us more broadband. Tim Fitzsimmons has more now on all the wires that go into making our high-speed world.
The challenges of scaling up high-speed internet are twofold, infrastructure and regulations. On the regulations side, you'd think San Francisco would have super-fast internet, but only businesses can get a fiber-optic hookup, leaving residents with slower copper cable.
And the reason is that the city of San Francisco makes it extremely difficult to deploy broadband.
That's Baron Shoka, president of Tech Freedom in Washington, which says the government shouldn't be selling internet access.
The way that the city structures things, neighbors get the ability to block anything they don't like.
Dane Jasper is president and CEO of Sonic.net, an internet provider in the San Francisco Bay Area. They do have to get approval from residents to roll out the boxes that bring fast internet to homes, but
we'd certainly like to see the city opening up access to its 170 miles of dark fiber.
Dark fiber, meaning the municipal cables already set up but not being used. Even if you can figure that part out, providers still have to deal with infrastructure, everything from the poles to the wire-filled tubes in the ground called conduits. Corinne McSherry from the Electronic Frontier Foundation says one popular concept is called a dig-once policy. When cities dig up a street to, say, redo a sewer line,
that's a good time to allow folks to install conduit, which then can be used to provide better broadband service.
If the poles and tubes are owned by cities, providers have to negotiate with them. If they're owned by telecoms like AT&T, providers find themselves negotiating with competitors. In Washington, I'm Tim Fitzsimmons for Marketplace.
Corporate boards of directors don't usually get a whole lot of press unless something is going horribly wrong at the company in question. They are elected or appointed to basically be the CEO's boss, keep an objective, non-executive eye on things. There is an idea floating around out there, though, to fire boards, basically, and replace them with a company of board professionals. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour explains.
Corporate boards are made up of individual human beings, and that makes them only human, if you ask Professor Todd Henderson at the University of Chicago Law School.
Part-timers, non-experts who are paid a relative pittance for their work.
His solution, in a paper he wrote with Professor Stephen Bainbridge at UCLA, is to outsource the board. Not to India necessarily, but just to some outside firm, just like how companies use law firms or accounting firms.
Firms are risk-sharing devices. They provide economies of scale and scope, so expertise is more readily available.
They argue this could improve transparency and efficiency. Firms would compete for business. They could be hired and fired. It's a free market strategy. But some observers question the idea's utility.
A lot has changed.
Donna Dabney directs the Governance Center at the Conference Board. She says boards are more professional these days.
1980 or 1990, even, you would have boards that were filled with the CEO's friends. But following Enron and the other scrutiny that has come to public company boards since the turn of the 21st century, you're seeing less and less and less of that.
Mateo Arena teaches finance at Marquette University. He says using outside firms isn't problem-free. Credit rating agencies, for example, are hired by the firms they rate.
And many argue that this is the reason why credit rating agencies are slow to downgrade firms when financial conditions deteriorate.
Questions aside, the idea is being tested out. At least one firm in the U.S. has been created to offer board services to private companies. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Tomorrow is one of the most anticipated days on the Hollywood calendar. Oscar nominations come out at the crack of dawn, L.A. time. But that also means that today is a day a lot of people in the movie business aren't so fond of. The day we found out the contenders for the year's worst in film, the not-so-coveted Golden Raspberry Awards, or Razzies. The 35th Annual Razzie Awards will be held on Oscars Eve. That is February the 21st. John Wilson is the guy who started it all. Hi, John.
Hello.
Give me the origin story. 35 years ago, you decided to do these things because why?
Well, in 1980, I actually saw 250 films because of the job that I had.
You wrote scripts for film trailers, or you wrote copy for film trailers.
Yes, and when you see that many, you begin to realize, you know what? The odds don't favor the good stuff. And without even doing any research, I could come up with a dozen nominees if there were an award for the worst achievements in film. The very first ceremony we did was part of an Oscar party. I made a cardboard podium, put a foam ball on a broomstick, and it was just very silly. We are still very silly. But now the whole world seems to be listening, and the direct just keeps coming.
And more power to you. How does it work? How do you get nominated for a Razzie, and then how are the winners decided upon?
Well, we look at what's called the tomato meter at Rotten Tomatoes.
Rotten Tomatoes, yeah.
And if it gets below a 50 positive, we'll think about it. We actually have at least one nominee this year that literally has a zero at Rotten Tomatoes.
You're going for the worst of the worst.
It's called Kirk Cameron's Saving Christmas.
Wow.
Do you ever feel like Christmas has been hijacked?
The slogan for which was, let's put Christ back in Christmas.
I confess that I did. I saw one of the nominees on an airplane not too long ago, the Transformers 4.
Yeah.
I don't think it's a truck at all.
Oh, my Lord.
I think we just found a Transformer.
It was so bad.
The way you can tell a Razzie nominee is you're watching it on a plane and you still think about walking out.
Is this whole thing a business for you? Is there a profit margin here for you? Or is this sort of out of the goodness of your heart?
People often misunderstand and think that I've gotten rich off this, which no, I have not. Or they think it's coming from a place of anger and hatred. And actually, it's not. It's coming from a place of silliness. The phrase that I like to use is, we don't consider ourselves a slap in the face. We're a banana peel on the floor. Most of these people got paid millions and millions of dollars, and they've still got those millions and millions of dollars. And when you got paid that and you gave us Transformers Age of Extinction, I kind of think you don't have a lot of room to go, well, you're just being mean. You know what? You made that movie.
Now, I mean, there are some, you know, you get mixed reactions, I guess you could say, in Hollywood about these.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the quote from Michael Caine, which I love, is that you guys are the pustule on the butt of Hollywood. Sylvester Stallone, who's been nominated 30 times, hates you guys.
Uh-huh.
There are people who actually show up to accept their Razzies.
Yes, Sandra Bullock.
Please welcome to our stage Academy Award nominated and Razzie Award winning Sandra Bullock.
She was up for both awards the same year. She was nominated for ours for a horrible little thing called All About Steve. And she was up for the Oscar for, I think it was called Blindside.
Yeah. For which she won. I mean, you know.
Yes, yeah. Yes. And she, the coolest thing about it was actually not the night she was at our show. It was that walking up the red carpet at the Oscars the next night. Every single crew mentioned the Razzies and said, God, that's real, that you had the nerve to do that.
And, they'll sit side by side in a nice little shelf somewhere. The Razzie maybe on a different shelf lower. Yes.
She was very funny and very cute and very endearing.
Over 35 years, you have seen, mm-hmm, I can't even tell you how many movies, most of them terrible.
What, I can't even tell you.
What have you learned? What's your takeaway?
I think the movies that really work are movies that mean something to the people who made them. I think it's almost impossible to make a good movie if all you're looking at is the box office. Generally speaking, if you're making the movie to make money, you're probably not making a good movie.
John Wilson is the creator of the Razzies. You can check the entire list of nominees on our website, their website. They've got a YouTube channel, all kinds of stuff. John, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you. Would you like me to sign off with the traditional Razzie sound?
Have
you got one already?
No, go ahead.
Yes. The name of our awards is taken from the fact that when you blow a raspberry, it sounds like this. And now someone will have to clean your mic.
That's great radio right there, man. That's just great radio. Thanks a lot, John. We'll see you.
Thank you so much.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, the first issue of Charlie Hebdo hit newsstands in France today, the first issue after the events of last week, of course. You've heard about that. 3 million copies sold out within hours. Would-be readers here will have a tougher time finding a copy. The magazine's distributor in the U.S. and Canada said just 300 copies in French will be sold here. They will get here Friday morning on an Air France flight, CNN says. Going to New York City, Washington, D.C., Chicago, L.A., and San Francisco, if you're curious. All right, we're out of here. We have got to go. Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Michael Raphael, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.